Bonjour à toutes et tous. Aujourd'hui, je suis ravi de vous retrouver avec à mes côtés David Graeber. David Graeber est anthropologue américain. Il enseigne à la London School of Economics et c'est la première fois hors série que je reçois un anthropologue. Je suis ravi de le faire parce qu'il me semble que les anthropologues ont apporté énormément de choses aux pensées critiques. Je pense en premier lieu à Marshall Salins, qui a été votre directeur de thèse et qui a écrit un magnifique ouvrage sur la notion d'abondance, qui a déconstruit aussi l'idée de nature humaine en montrant que c'était ce qu'il appelle une illusion occidentale. Quand on regarde aussi d'autres anthropologues comme Pierre Clastres, par exemple, qui nous a montré qu'une organisation politique n'était pas nécessairement étatique, ou aujourd'hui un de vos collègues, on peut peut-être dire James C. Scott, qui s'intéresse beaucoup, lui, aux résistances des dominés, en montrant comment derrière des formes de soumission apparentes, il peut y avoir malgré tout de la critique. Je pense que tous ces travaux, et y compris les vôtres dont on va parler aujourd'hui, sur des sujets aussi importants que la dette ou que le travail, montre à quel point cette discipline, l'anthropologie, a des choses à nous apprendre sur le monde et des choses à apporter à la critique. Alors, je vous ai présenté d'un point de vue académique. Vous êtes donc à la London School of Economics. Vous êtes aussi, et je pense que c'est important de le dire d'emblée, un militant, un activiste qui a pris part au mouvement altermondialiste, au mouvement anarchiste, qui a été aussi très présent à Occupy Wall Street. On y reviendra. Un dernier point pour nos abonnés, je faisais la transition à l'anglais parce que cet entretien va donc avoir lieu en anglais, il sera sous-titré en français et je demande à celles et ceux qui nous regardent et qui seraient anglophones de l'indulgence vis-à-vis de mon accent.
Okay.
After having introduced you,
thank you
in
for
French,
that lovely introduction. I didn't understand it.
Okay, that's perfect. So we can do the interview in French, or?
Well, yeah.
In English, perfect.
You speak French, I'll speak English.
Okay. So the first question will be personal,
okay.
Because I said that you are from the US. You
yes.
grew up in New York,
mm-hmm.
but you work
in London.
You live
yeah.
in London.
Yeah.
Why did you leave your country?
Well, I got in a bit of trouble. I think this is one of the things which the real history can only be known at some point in the future. I was at Yale. It was my first real job. And of course, junior jobs at Yale are inherently temporary because they tend not to give people tenure. But I figured, okay, well, if they're not going to give me tenure anyway, I might as well have some fun with this. I don't have to disguise my real political affiliations. So I got involved in the global justice movement, ultra-globalization, and I just figured I'd stay out of politics in Yale itself, you know, in New Haven. I would just be a scholar, and then I could go be an anarchist elsewhere, and what could they really do? It turns out that the senior faculty at Yale took great offense at this. In fact, well, there was an additional problem in that there was a student unionization drive. And while I was very friendly with the students, I tried to stay out of that. But there was a strike coming up of graduate students. And in a way, they tested my loyalty by trying to kick out my best student, who also happened to be one of the union organizers on some transparently made up pretext. And no, so I was sort of put in a position where I had to choose sides. And of course, I defended her and we saved her. She's a professor now, so it worked out well. But at that point, they were like, aha, we knew it. You know, so they came after me and came up with this very complex, unusual way to deny me a contract before I could even come up for tenure. And the students then protested. And I think this is where things kind of went off a little bit. I thought I wouldn't sue them because I mean, a lot of lawyers said, my God, we never get material this good, because some of those guys are crazy. They were doing things like calling students' parents, warning them that they're taking classes of a dangerous radical, loony stuff. I figured, okay, I won't sue them. I wouldn't necessarily want to hire someone who'd sued his last department. But in America, it's not so much that. It's students. When students protest on your behalf, suddenly you're a pariah, because everyone says, oh, he'll turn our students against us. And so I found myself in this situation. I thought, okay, well, I got fired from Yale, but as an anarchist, you know, if I didn't get fired from Yale, maybe I should ask myself what I'm doing wrong. On the other hand, what I didn't expect was that no one else would hire me. Suddenly I had this period. I applied for 20, 30 jobs, and no one even looked at me. I was just eliminated, first cut, you know. And before that, this had never happened, but only in America. Whereas, meanwhile, everywhere else in the world, I had people approaching me trying to convince me to come up, or at least apply to their universe, everyone from Nanterre to China, you know. In the end, I ended up in the UK.
That's very interesting because it goes to my second question. Your country, this country, America, is often presented as the biggest democracy world. And you refuse to this statement that America is a democracy. So what is for you a democracy?
Well, I take the original meaning of democracy, which is the one embraced by the people who actually wrote the Constitution of the US. When I want to annoy American intellectuals, I always like to point out that nowhere in the Declaration of Independence or in the Constitution does it say anything about America being a democracy. In fact, the people who wrote those documents were quite explicit that they hated democracy, they considered it the worst form of government, and that the form of government they were developing was designed to defend against the threat of democracy, as they put it. In fact, if you read the speeches that were made at the Constitutional Convention, the very first speech was a protege of George Washington, governor of Virginia, who began by saying, you know, we have a problem here in America. There's a real danger that democracy might break out. You know, the threat of democracy is something we can't ignore. And at that time, democracy and anarchy were used almost interchangeably as meaning, you know, lack of any sort of permanent structures of coercive government, direct democracy, as we'd call it now, popular self-governance. And even the idea of representative democracy was, which Tom Paine introduced, was not really considered democracy. What they thought of was they were creating a republic, which was quite explicitly modeled on Polybius's idea of what the Roman constitution was like, combining the perfect balance of monarchical, oligarchic, and democratic elements. Mm-hmm. So the Senate was going to be the aristocracy, the president was going to be the monarch, and the Congress would have limited powers over finance, and that was the democratic element. They were quite explicit about this is a republic, not a democracy, and conservatives in America will still say that. You know, they're honest about these things. Meanwhile, what happened was in the 1830s, there's a Canadian anarchist scholar named Francis Dupuy Dery who's written about this, that, you know, in France it was quite the same. After the revolution, they were all explicitly anti-democratic. Until the 1830s, something happened. Essentially, the franchise was widened enough that a bunch of politicians started calling themselves Democrats. And it was almost a term of provocation, sort of the way you'd say queer or something like that. Yeah, I am a Democrat, what's it to you? And they started winning elections. So within a decade, everybody started like calling themselves Democrats. And what were originally created as republics, which were anti-democratic, were relabeled democracy. So you have this completely contradictory situation. The way I always point out is, well, if you look at America, you know, everybody likes the idea of democracy. If ordinary people in America, you know, they're very pro-democratic. But everybody, you know, loves democracy, hates politicians, and is a little dubious about the very idea of government. So obviously, if democracy just meant electing politicians to run a government, that would make no sense. So there's some notion of democracy as self-governance there, even though people can't quite articulate what it would really mean.
Okay, so true democracy is like direct democracy, if I understand.
Yeah, it's a principle of self-governance and autonomy.
And in 2011, you participated to a worldly new movement, which was Occupy Wall Street. It was a movement against the global finance, but nowadays, in like 6 years later, the finance still exists and Wall Street still exists. So some people say that Occupy Wall Street has been defeated or has failed. You agree with that? Or?
No, they started saying Occupy Wall Street had failed about 2 weeks into it. It was this endless chorus of failure.
Beginning, they said...
Journalists were adamant, you know, that trying to set it up so that it didn't work. And I would occasionally point this out, that you know, journalists had been essentially saying, oh, radicals should work within the political system and try to create incremental change. And for 30 years, you know, they had been doing that. And everything kept getting worse and worse, you know? But you never heard a journalist say, well, obviously that approach failed. Now you should try something else, you know? However, Occupy, if it didn't achieve immediate results, failure, obviously it's a failure. And it's especially ironic considering that, I mean, I think the way I see it, I think it has something to do with this sort of culture of immediate reaction. You expect to punch a button and something's going to happen. Now, people don't understand that social movements take a long time. And the more ambitious the social transformation envisioned by that movement, the longer it's likely to take. I mean, it's not like feminism, you know, managed to overthrow patriarchy in a month or two. And it sets something in motion which is going to take generations. The same, even something like abolitionism, it took a generation. Genuinely transformational movements always take a long time. So you have to start by changing the framework of analysis. And I think in that sense, Occupy was staggeringly successful. In fact, it did more in about 3 or 4 months than I can think of any other social movement doing. If you look at just what people were arguing about and discussing, right before Occupy, the entire debate was about balancing the budget. You know, how much are we going to cut? How much are we going to privatize? If you look at Davos, for example, someone pointed out that, you know, before Occupy, I think there was one time there was one discussion of social inequality as a general issue. After that, all discussions, you know, what to do about inequality was number one. It's not clear if they have, in fact, done anything. But there's also a lag. And this is actually interesting. I remember in 2008, reading an article about global security coordination, that all the different intelligence agencies, police forces, and security systems were sort of trying to coordinate against what they expected to be the inevitable riots. And then they didn't really happen. They were kind of surprised. They said, well, like, maybe we just missed that bullet. And of course, 3 years later, suddenly everywhere in the world it did. Similarly, there was a lag 3 or 4 years between when the movements were suppressed, which they were quite violently suppressed. That story has not really been told. When those movements were suppressed and when they began to take explicit political form within the parliamentary structures, which, again, people were thinking would happen right away, and then they thought maybe it's not going to happen at all. But it did. It took, four or five years before it really did. But in all the same countries, it did.
One interesting point also for me in Occupy Wall Street was about the decisions, because most of the decisions were taken, and you wrote it in a book about Occupy, were taken by consensus.
By consensus, yeah.
Why did you prefer rather than the majority rule?
I mean, it's been our experience that majority rule historically only exists when you have a means of coercion. I mean, in effect, any system of decision making where you have no ability to compel a minority to go along with a majority decision is going to be a consensus decision. You can have a consensus to agree with whatever a majority decides, but it's usually not the best way to go about it in a non-coercive situation. Now, this comes out of the anarchist tradition, but it also comes out of feminism. It comes out of certain religious traditions, dissenting religious traditions like the Quakers. And the tradition of consensus in America, for example, largely grows out of a reaction to the sort of macho militant leadership styles of the 1960s. And it was led especially by women, queers, there was a queer Quaker, actually, who sort of revealed the secrets of how to do consensus, which the Quakers had considered to be a religious sacrament that they didn't want to impose on others. But the history is very interesting, actually. And it was developed as a way of creating the kind of decision-making structure that could exist in a free society which didn't have systematic bureaucracies of coercion. And you know, it makes a lot of sense. If you look at history, where you have majority vote, it's usually where people are armed. Greek democracy was based on, Aristotle points this out, the franchise is extended to those people who have weapons. Mm-hmm. So if you have a cavalry, it's an aristocracy. If you have a hoplite system where you have this expensive armor, it's going to be an oligarchy. If it's light infantry or naval power, then it's going to be a democracy, because anybody can row. And but armed people, you have to take their opinions into account. And, if it's 60-40, you see this in Xenophon, when they're all trapped in Persia, and they say, okay, let's have a vote. Our commanders are dead. What are we going to do? And if you have a 60-40 vote, you'd know who'd win in a fight, so you do that. Pirate ships, everybody was armed, they use majority vote. But where you don't have coercive means of enforcement, well, the stupidest thing you could do is say, okay, let's all have a contest and see who publicly loses and is humiliated. I mean, they're not going to want to go along with this. So you come to a way to make consensus isn't about getting everyone to agree. It's getting everyone to consent, to a process where everyone's perspectives are taken into account. If they have real objections, it will be incorporated and things will be changed to the point where everyone says, well, all right.
Occupy Wall Street and other movements, for instance, in France last year we had Nuit Debout, in Spain they had the same year the Indignados, the 15M. It's movements against austerity policies. Mm-hmm. And austerity is always or often justified by public debt. Mm. You wrote a very, very massive and important book about debt. I won't ask you to summarize the 600 pages in 2 minutes. But my question is about public debt. What is it so difficult today to advocate for public debt to
public
be cancelled?
Yes. It's an interesting thing because everyone treats the fact that there is government debt as a scandal, but at the same time, since the 1690s, really, you've had no government that is not based on deficit spending and on public debt. So there seems to be this strange paradox that, government shouldn't really do it, but every single one always does. Clearly, in a case like that, there's a structural feature that people are ignoring, and that structural feature is the fact that modern money is public debt. You can go back to the Bank of England in 1694. It was sort of paradigm for this. A consortium of bankers lent £1.2 million in silver, actually, to one of those Georges, I can't remember which one he was, to the king who was fighting a war here in France. And it's always debt really financing the means of coercion of some kind. He said, all right, in exchange for this, I'll give you a monopoly of the right to lend that £1.2 million, which I now owe you, to other people in the form of government banknotes, or in the form of they became the Bank of England, in the form of banknotes. So those are IOUs. Modern money is government debt, which has been monetized. It was great for them, because they're getting 8% interest from the king and another 8% interest from the people they lend it to, But if the king ever paid back the debt, there'd be no money. The entire system is based on the existence of circulating debt. And George Osborne, actually said, this just shows what a complete bullshit artist this guy was. Oh, we're going to pay back that debt too. He's going to go back to 1694 and wipe out the entire basis of the financial system. But in fact, there's a simple sort of what they call accounting identities. Since money is circulating debt, and most of it, of course, is created not by government spending but by private loans by banks. But again, banks are given a monopoly of the right not to write IOUs. You can write an IOU, I can write an IOU, right? And if people trust us, you can give that IOU to someone else. So if you do that, you create money. But that money is useless for tax purposes, for legal purposes. So what government does is say that only IOUs issued by banks can be used to conduct any sort of legal business. Mm-hmm. Now, most money is that. So when I say accounting identities, what I mean is, it's got to be one or the other. If government debt goes down, then private debt goes up. Either that or the amount of money in circulation changes. The amount of money is constant. One or the other has to be the case. So if the government does pay their debts, well, we're all going to go into debt. It's hardly an economically beneficial thing. And in there's occasions where people have actually taken that rhetoric seriously, and Clinton did, you know. It's usually the Democrats in America who really take this stuff seriously. The Republicans know it's all a fraud. You know, and that's, I'm going to pay back the government debt. We're going to run a surplus. And Alan Greenspan, who was, you know, running the equivalent to the Bank of England, the Federal Reserve, panicked. He said, no, this is terrible. You can't do that. And he had to make up a reason, because he couldn't admit the real reason is that, you know, the money supply would dry up unless banks managed to make an equivalent amount of loans, and there was just nobody willing to borrow that much money. So it would create a depression. But he couldn't say that, because that would be admitting the entire basis of the economic system was not as it was represented. So you know what he said? He said, no, this is terrible, because it will lead to communism. If the government runs a surplus, they're going to have to do something. So they're going to buy stuff up. What are they going to buy? They're going to buy stuff people want. So they're going to start buying up healthcare, hospitals. They're going to buy up companies, and before long, we'll have a socialist economy.
Okay. And debt is not only an economic problem; it's also a moral problem, because we are used to think that we have a moral duty to pay our debt.
Yeah, rich people don't, but poor people do. It's quite an interesting thing that way.
Yes, okay.
I like to talk about the communism of the rich. You know, they'll bail each other out; they just won't bail you. Yeah, I think Michael Hudson put it quite well, that the modern financialization of the economy only occurred when rich people figured out that poor people actually do feel obliged to pay their debts, unlike themselves.
Okay. That's,
you know,
very interesting.
Yeah, publishers sure as hell don't. I've noticed this. People ask me sometimes, why don't you become a writer? Why do you, you know, you could make a lot more money. Why don't you... you know, why do you stay like working for academia? It's so bureaucratized. It's so depressing. I always say, well, you know, there's one thing about academic life which is different than any of the creative industries, if you're a writer, if you're an artist or a musician, which is that if you work for a university, they never ever pretend they just forgot to pay you. There it is, every month. You know, they give you the money, it's predictable. Publisher, it's like, what? Were we supposed to give you money? Oh, right. They'll just always try to get out of their debts if they possibly can. But at any rate, yes, morality. The fascinating thing is why people feel that way. And what I was really trying to get at in that book on debt, it was very much an activist question. Why is it that when the idea of debt cancellation comes up, these sort of moral red flags come out, even with people who, you know, seem very decent and politically progressive. You know, you'll describe terrible things happening in the third world and babies dying of preventable diseases and collapse of hopes and lives, and they'll be very sympathetic. And as soon as you say, well, you know, debt cancellation would solve this problem, they're like, whoa, I mean, you got to pay your debts. I mean, they borrow the money. So why is it the morality of debt seems to trump any other morality? For so many otherwise, you know, people who would never really approve of the killing of babies under any other circumstance. And I started looking into it, and the more I looked into it, the more this sort of moral ambiguity, this moral contradiction goes back thousands and thousands of years. It can, you know, almost everyone who's lived under a monetized economy anyway, in human history, has seemed to simultaneously believe, on the one hand, that paying back your debts is the essence of morality, and on the other hand, that people who lend money are evil. And it's hard to reconcile these two ideas, but people seem to hold them at the same time. So that's what I was really investigating in the book.
Yeah. That was the question. Okay. And nowadays in Europe, we have some politicians who, like, I don't know, Jeremy Corbyn, for instance, or Pablo Iglesias, or Alexis Tsipras. In France, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who dare to question the legitimacy of public debt. As an anarchist, because at the beginning you said that politically you are an anarchist, how do you look at these far-left politicians? Should we vote for them? Or?
Well, you know, as an anarchist, I don't tell people what to do. So, you know,
would you vote for them?
I haven't voted in a long time. I can't vote in England. I mean, I've done some definite work helping out with the Corbin people. I'm particularly friends with John McDonnell, who's now the Shadow Chancellor. But this is because, in a way, we see eye to eye in a lot of things. I mean, we don't. It was kind of a new experience for me. And 2010, during the student movement kicked off with a direct action where we ended up basically smashing through the windows and occupying Tory headquarters. Milbank. To this day, nobody's quite sure whether we really broke through the police lines or whether the police, who'd heard their own budgets were going to be cut, intentionally let us do it. But at any rate, it was a great victory. And it was. I still have little pieces of Milbank glass. I was thinking of making jewelry out of them. John McDonnell sort of came to, I was at Goldsmiths at the time, I wasn't at LSE then, gave a little talk and came out in ringing support of the actions at Milbank. And I was like, "You're a politician? That's amazing. We don't have politicians like that in my country." Later, Corbyn's son, who was working for him as an aide, asked me to take part in what they called the People's Parliament, because he'd been involved in the Greater London Council, which was the radical government of London under Thatcher. And so the one reason that Thatcher eventually got rid of London government was because they were doing all sorts of crazy things. They were doing things like opening up the fallout shelters as homeless shelters and allowing, you know, sort of punks to wander around with the classified files and so forth. But one thing they did was they set up a direct democracy system where anyone who got a certain number of signatures could have a debate on any topic they wanted in the public forums. And he thought, let's do that in Parliament. I can have a meeting on anything I want. And he brought me in to sort of like help with that. I gave one of the introductory talks. I facilitated meetings on, you know, how to eliminate the police and things like that. I thought, all right, this guy's all right. And he went, his philosophy, as he puts it, is that social change can only come about through a confluence of three factors. You need to have internal parliamentary action, you need to have radical syndicalism, radical trade unionism, but you also need to have, he always says, insurrection, or as we now politely prefer to say, direct action. And the question is how to coordinate those things in a way that they reinforce one another. And I think that's an important question. I would never work for a political candidate, for a political party, I wouldn't join one. But I am interested in working with people who would work with us in a way that doesn't undercut what we're doing and is interested in finding out, you know, if as long as we don't undercut what they're doing. Because I think for the interim, there's got to be alliances. And working, you know, we know what a bad alliance looks like. You know, in America, the left wing of the Democratic Party tried to co-opt Occupy, and it was very clear they just wanted to turn us into a left-wing version of the Tea Party. We resisted, and when they discovered we weren't going to play their game, they basically sent the cops in to beat us up. We know that people like Syriza in Greece really tried to co-opt and ended up destroying grassroots social movements. So we know how this could work badly. Is it possible that it could work well? One reason I've been interested in the Kurdish experiments in Rojava is because they're actually dealing with the same question coming from another direction. When I was in Syria, you know, what I saw was a dual power situation, but one which might be unique in world history because it's a dual power situation in which the same guys had basically set up both sides. On the one hand, they had something that looked like a government. It had, you know, a parliament, they had ministers, so forth and so on. And at the same time, they had a series of bottom-up, directly democratic assemblies, democracy in the capital D sense I was talking about earlier. Sort of broadly inspired by ideas from Murray Bookchin with their own revolutionary experience, Kurdish traditions all sort of mixed together. But, you know, they said this is not a state because anybody with a gun is answerable to the bottom-up groups and not the top-down ones. But nonetheless, it's the same thing. It's how do you coordinate between structures? You know, they have to have the government-like structures to deal with outsiders because no one's going to take them seriously. They say we are a confederation of directly democratic assemblies. But the question is how you can set that up but at the same time create a sort of a, you know, some kind of membrane between the bottom-up groups and the top-down groups that each one doesn't, you know, undermine the other. And so that problem has to be answered for any sort of long-term transformational strategy. So that's one reason I'm willing to work with people like that, if I think they're serious about trying to create that relation. Whether it's possible in a parliamentary system, you know, in Syria they're inventing everything pretty much all cloth. Yes. We don't have that luxury in a place like London. It might not work, you know, but it's worth a try.
So it's interesting because it's a combination of different types of action that can bring social transformation.
Yeah.
You spoke of Rojava. You went
I was there a couple of years ago, very briefly. But yes. It was kind of a fact-finding tour. I went with Janet Beale, who's Murray Bookchin's partner, and a bunch of scholars. And you know, it took us through. We went to assemblies. We went to schools. We went to sort of gamut of cooperatives, so forth and so on.
And what happens there? Is it similar to what happened in Spain?
It's very similar in a lot of ways. It's similar because there's preparation. There's like generations, really, of people sort of organizing covertly around the day this could happen. And, you know, they tried it in Turkey, too, but they were all killed or arrested. They finally had a space where they could carry out what they'd been sort of covertly developing for many years. And so in that way, it's very much like Spain. In other ways, it's different. They have the advantage that insofar as there is something like a government, it's on their side, which is very different than in Spain. On the other hand, they also have their own internal struggles between authoritarian and anti-authoritarian elements, which are very complex and subtle, and they don't like to talk to outsiders about explicitly, but as you can imagine, there's a lot of politics going on.
And I have a question about weapons, because when you are the Kurdish people in Rojava or the Zapatistas in Mexico, you are fighting against authoritarian or totalitarian forces, so it's legitimate to use weapons. But in countries like England, France, the US, what do you think of violent direct action? I know you are okay for civil disobedience, but civil disobedience is
usually you mean by violence. My personal philosophy is that don't do anything that will hurt innocents unless you absolutely know that it will have a positive effect. And basically, you can't absolutely know that. You know, I mean, if somebody's attacking you, well, that's a different story. But aggressive action, property destruction, I just think it's absurd to get all worked up over property destruction. In Seattle, for example, there was a lot of broken windows, and people still go on and on about it. Not mostly people who are not part of the movement but looking on, but much more the sort of, what we like to call the violent peace police. You know, the only people who were actually beaten up in a lot of these ultra-globalization movements were people, black bloc people breaking windows who are then violently attacked by hippies who are supposedly nonviolent. There's a lot of strange contradiction emerging in these situations. But my own feeling, if you take something like that, a window, it's just morally absurd to make an issue out of it. If there was a baby about to fall off a ledge and the only way you could save them was by breaking a window that didn't belong to you, would anyone sane ever call that a violent act? Of course not. So why is it different if it's 1,000 babies, which is basically what it was in that case? I mean, there are people dying of structural adjustment, of the effects of austerity policies in the global south, simply because people didn't know about it. And as soon as they did, that changed. We did save babies by breaking windows in that case. I don't think anybody in their right mind would call that violent. But the point is, you don't know it's going to work. And on the other hand, if it doesn't work, you broke some windows. So what? On the other hand, you know, if you're blowing up a bomb and it didn't work, well, there's some guy with no legs, you know? I mean, so I think that your tactics should be attuned to the damage it's going to do in a world where you never can be quite certain what the political effect of an action is going to be. That's my personal ethos.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. We spoke a lot of democracy. Let's go to its opposite, bureaucracy, because you also wrote a big book about bureaucracy. This word was very used in the 60s, in the 70s, but nowadays I don't really hear it. What do you mean by bureaucracy first?
Okay, well, first of all, by bureaucracy, I'm talking about a sort of administrative order, ostensibly meritocratic, hierarchical, based in chains of command, impersonal. Well, most of the standard Weberian definitions of bureaucracy apply, but we should bear in mind that Weber was quite explicit that bureaucracy could exist equally in the public and private sector. You know, corporate capitalism is essentially bureaucratic capitalism, and this is what we've lost. We've come up with a rhetoric whereby governments are inherently bureaucratic and the private sector never is. So we have a strange topsy-turvy world where you can, you know, walk into the Apple store and say, here, look, my screen is broken. And they say, yeah, your screen is broken. I say, well, can I have it fixed? And they said, no, you have to make an appointment for a week later for a guy to tell you your screen is broken. You know, it's a classic bureaucratic runaround, you know. Yeah, but you don't call it bureaucracy, you know.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Why is it not? It's the same thing. So I actually did a look at Google n-grams, which measures the percentage of a word as a among all words used in books in different historical periods. And you could see exactly how bureaucracy goes up until about 1973. It hits a peak, and then it starts going steadily downwards again. And I thought, well, is this because there's less bureaucracy? What happens if you put in a word like paperwork, and it goes through the ceiling, you know, or additional documentation required, you know, any sort of like bureaucratic term, they just go through the ceiling. So we have more and more bureaucracy, but we talk about it less and less. And this is the problem that I was looking at. And especially disturbing because this idea that bureaucracy is essentially means government, it comes out of the 60s. And what it is it's a right-wing bastardization of a left-wing countercultural discourse. You know, in the 60s, everybody's complaining about government bureaucrats, union bureaucrats, a sort of stifling social democratic corporatist welfare state. And it was indeed very stifling. But that moment of rebellion and this idea that, like, social democracy, state socialism, fascism have a lot more in common than they want to acknowledge, which was a radical idea in the 60s, has now become the most reactionary idea possible. But people will still repeat it. You know, if you listen to right-wing people talking about, you know, Obama's healthcare reform, they'll say exactly that. It's both communism and fascism at the same time. You know? And so that sort of 60s counterculture discourse has been taken up by the right. And people on the left are put in this horrible situation of having to defend democracy or feeling that they need to. And the forms of bureaucracy that exist nowadays are more and more incorporate market elements. So you have this sort of horrific, you know, Clinton, Blair sort of neoliberal combination of the worst elements of bureaucracy and the market fused together into this sort of political package so unlovely that, I mean, nobody could really be for it, you know, except for maybe a middle manager of some kind, a hospital administrator. Those guys like it, I guess. But everybody else hates it. But, you know, everybody sort of feels obliged to defend this anyway because the only alternative they can conceive is this right-wing anti-bureaucratic rhetoric. But the thing is that the right-wing anti-bureaucratic rhetoric is a complete lie. And this is what I was trying to document in the book. I came up with a term, the iron law of liberalism. I don't come up with any clever phrases. I realize this is why I'm not quoted as much as I should be. So I said, okay, I'm going to make up some phrases now. The iron law of liberalism.
What is it?
It says that any market reform which is adopted ostensibly to reduce red tape and paperwork and unleash market forces instead will in fact have the effect of creating more regulations, more paperwork, and more bureaucrats than existed before. And I think this can be empirically tested and discovered to be true. The most striking figures I found had to do with Russia. After the fall of the Soviet Union in the 10 years from, I think it was 1992 to 2003, 11 years, the total number of civil servants went up by 25%. It went up from 1 million to 1.25 million. That's amazing, considering the economy itself shrank considerably during that period. Yet they had more civil servants, and not despite the fact that with the privatization, they also had private bureaucrats. So, you know, probably the total number of bureaucrats doubled after the fall of the Soviet Union. That's what Jeffrey Sachs actually managed to achieve. You know, there's a reason he's so upset now. I think that's always the case. I think that market reforms have created more and more and more bureaucrats and more paperwork. So we live in a world which is completely unprecedented, where, you know, it's impossible to actually measure how many hours of our lives are spent filling out forms. I saw, I don't know how they came up with this, but someone determined that the average American spends 6 months of their lives waiting for the light to change. I wonder how much they spend waiting for things to download. Another one, but similarly, filling out forms, I'm sure it must be at least that much. You know, we spend more time doing paperwork than anybody, any population that's ever existed. Yet we don't think about it as bureaucracy anymore because it's sort of the water in which we swim. We can't imagine the world would be different. And, you know, application forms. I had a friend whose daughter was talented, piano, clarinet. She was a musician. And you know, she was 12 years old. To get her into a music school required a 40-page application form, the two-week process. I mean, what the hell is going on? This never used to be the case.
Yeah. So liberalism is not deregulation, it creates exactly. Bureaucracy.
Well, what they say deregulation is the most deceptive, it's a dishonest term. I mean, in America, deregulation of the airlines means going from a, you know, sort of controlled competition between a small series of oligopolies to sort of lots and lots of small firms competing, whereas, you know, the same thing with the phones or communications. But on the other hand, when it's banking, it's the other way around. It used to be lots of little banks, and now there's a control. You know, either way, it's called deregulation. It can mean anything. I mean, basically, it means changing the regulatory structure in a way I like. But, you know, if you get to call it deregulation first, then you win.
Okay. So liberalism creates bureaucracy. It also creates second things, which you call bullshit jobs.
Ah, yes.
Can you explain us what is bullshit jobs? Because you say that it has took a very, very large place in modern
economy. Yeah, I didn't know how large, to be honest. This is a little bit of a journey of discovery for me. I wrote a piece 2013. I had a friend who was setting up a new radical magazine called Strike. And it was a spin-off from the International Times, which is a very old countercultural magazine, still exists on the web. Anyway, he decided to create a print version, and it was called Strike Magazine, and he solicited something from me. And at the time, I'd just written the book on debt, and everybody wanted me to talk about debt all the time. And I was rebelling, you know. I was like, if I just gave talks on debt for the rest of my life, I would actually have money. I could probably afford a house, which I can't do now. But, you know, it would be very stifling intellectually. And I thought, I want to, like, finally sort of all those things I'd always sort of thought about writing. You know, why is it we don't have flying cars and all those technologies we were promised? The philosophy of bullying. I mean, I had all these ideas that had been sort of going on about when drunk at parties or whatnot. And I was writing them all up. And this was one of the more experimental ones. I said, okay, I'll give you something. You say you'll let me write anything I want? Okay, here's one. What about all those people you meet? The way I put it, like, I'm not from a bourgeois background myself. I'm from actually quite a working class background. So often I live in all these very bourgeois environments now, and I feel kind of like an anthropologist, you know. I'm sort of trying to understand how people think and act. And one of the things I find fascinating is when you meet people and they're embarrassed to admit what they do. This happens to me a lot. And sometimes they're embarrassed to admit what they do because what they do is just kind of evil and bad. But often it's just because it's just nonsense. It isn't anything. They don't really do anything. You'll talk to people, say, I'm an anthropologist. What do you do? And they're like, nothing really. You don't really do. And you'll try to change the subject. And if you pin them down, they'll say, well, to be perfectly honest, I have this job in an office where they gave me some fancy title, but I work maybe 2 hours a week answering emails, and otherwise I'm just on Facebook all day, you know. Don't tell my boss, you know. And so you're constantly meeting people who, you know, say, well, they pay me a lot, but, like, I don't actually really do anything, you know. Or a computer could do my job, or I just pretend to work. So I was like, well, how common is this, you know? I mean, what percentage of people in offices are really not doing anything and they just don't want you to know. So I wrote this little piece. Let's imagine it's a lot of them. And at the time, I was thinking maybe 25%. I thought, well, that would explain a lot because, you know, back in the 1930s, Keynes was saying, he said 2025, but, you know, by 2015, we should have been almost there. He said we should have a 15-hour week by now because they're eliminating agriculture, they're eliminating a lot of industrial work. You know, if you keep the job balance, you know, more or less what it was in the 30s, well, we should have, you know, less than half the work. And in fact, if anything, we have more hours being worked nowadays. So what happened? And you know, the conventional narrative is, well, it's the rise of the service economy. You know, we're all selling each other fancy sushi and, you know, washing each other's dogs or whatnot. And you know, and actually, this is extremely deceptive. If you look at accurate breakdowns of what happened, most of what they call service jobs are not service jobs. If you look at real, you know, service jobs like cutting hair or things like that, they've remained pretty much constant at 20% throughout the 20th and into the 21st century. What's actually changed is administrative, clerical, supervisory jobs, information jobs. Basically, those guys sitting around in offices, which you don't know what they're doing. And so I suggested in the piece, well, maybe that's what happened. They've just basically made up jobs. I don't know how it happened. Obviously, nobody sat in some central committee and decided, like in the Soviet Union, they said, okay, we're going to have full employment. So sort of they knew that that would mean people would have to make up jobs. That didn't happen. But there's huge political pressure to create jobs. I mean, it's the one thing both the left and the right will always agree on. More jobs is good. You don't see people waving signs saying more jobs, you know, that, well, you see people waving signs saying more jobs. You don't see people waving signs saying more jobs that actually do something. You know, the demand is for jobs. And somehow then, we've have a situation where much in the same way as state socialist economies like Russia and China used to produce sort of phony proletarian jobs to keep everyone employed, we're creating phony white-collar jobs to keep everyone employed. How did that happen? It's not clear, but it has political effects that are profound. For example, it creates a sort of resentment of people who have real jobs, which is quite observable. In America, it's very, very clear. You have people getting angry at teachers or auto workers. How dare these people expect to have $25 an hour salaries and benefit packages and vacations? And it's like, well, why shouldn't they? You know, I mean, you don't seem to mind if some guy in an office doing nothing gets that kind of money. You know, so the idea seems to be like, you know, they get to do real work. They get to teach kids and make cars. They want benefits too. You know? So the political effects were disturbing. Anyway, so I wrote about this, and it was kind of a speculation. I didn't really know how many people there were like this. Although, as I said, there seemed to be a lot. Maybe I thought I was thinking as much as 20%, right? The piece went crazy. It's funny because I wrote it, and right before me and my girlfriend had planned to go off to a forest in Quebec, we had a little cabin, there was no internet, you know, so I could check my phone if I like went out in the right place in the lake, but otherwise, you know, I was cut off from the world. And, you know, we came in there with a big basket full of books, so we're going to get away from the world, just read and have fun. Okay, so we went off, and suddenly I'm looking at my phone, it's like, what the hell is going on? The piece went mad. Like, within 2 weeks, it had been translated into 13, 14 different languages. I was getting all these messages from people like, hi, I work in the financial services industry. I got this across my desk 8 different times today. We've been disseminating it. And it's like, I guess you're really not doing much if you can, you know, get this across your desk 8 times a day. But it clearly struck a chord. And a year later, the Strike magazine people pulled this kind of stunt where they, the day everybody's coming back from Christmas vacation, they put up quotes from the article, and they replaced advertisements with them and put them up in the Tube in London. And that created a little media storm, and that led to a poll. YouGov actually did a survey, and they asked people, do you think your job makes any difference, any meaningful contribution? They, you know, if it were to vanish, would anybody notice? 40%, actually, almost 40% said, no, my job makes no difference at all. It was 37, actually, 40% in Holland, where they did another survey. But that was people who were sure. Only 50% were absolutely sure their job actually did something. 13% didn't know.
Okay, and so you said that if we suppress all these bullshit jobs and perhaps if we also suppress bureaucracy, mm-hmm. we could achieve something like 15-hour work
week? That was what Keynes said we should have by 2025. I think so. Yeah. I mean, because remember, there's 40% of people say that their jobs are doing nothing. That's, you know, so that wouldn't reduce it to quite that extent. But then you have to talk about second-order bullshit jobs, right? Because, like, here you have an office where people are doing, you know, some completely stupid marketing thing, or they're reformatting documents from some French to German form for a tax dodge for a corporation. You know, this is some bullshit thing. Okay, so you have a bullshit corporation. But somebody's got to be the janitor, you know? Somebody's got to actually, like, do pest control for that building. Somebody's got to do security. So those are real jobs. They're doing real work, but they don't know they're doing it in support of bullshit. So, you know, if you get rid of that, well, you know, yeah, I think we could easily eliminate half the work.
In your books, you wrote a lot about economy, about debt. We talked about it before. And you have also some interesting reflection about money. Mm-hmm. Do you think it could be possible to have a society without money? And is it desirable? Or?
That's a hard question, because it depends on what you think money is. You know, if money is, at the very most minimal, money is a system of proportional value. So it's basically a way of saying, like, seven of those is equal to one of these. It's hard to imagine a complex society where people would not be making calculations like that at some point. But it's a long way from saying people would make calculations of proportional value to saying it is necessary to base one's life and even the basic means of subsistence on possession of a transferable IOU, which you can only get through in exchange for labor, you know, or commodities. I think that we're conflating a whole bunch of different elements. In a way, I fall back here on the tradition of Marcel Mauss, who was a revolutionary socialist and an anthropologist. And he wrote a famous essay in The Gift, which most people will probably have heard of. But most people aren't aware that he wrote that in response to Lenin's new economic policy. He was a cooperativist and trying to figure out ways of coordinating supply and demand, consumer co-ops and supplier co-ops, so as to eliminate sort of money transactions. You know, he was very excited about the Russian Revolution and then very upset. And when Lenin was forced to reintroduce the market and essentially capitalism, you know, his first reaction was, okay, Russia's the least monetized economy in Europe. If even they can't simply legislate the market economy away, we need to think a lot more seriously about what it is we're really objecting to here. You know, there's a whole series of different elements which we're combining and then imagining we can either have to keep or get rid of. And it's like, so I think in that sense, people think of him as sort of Proudhonian, which I don't think is really right. But he's kind of coming out of that idea of, like, some elements can be savage, some not. We have to figure out where the problem actually lies. And when it comes to money, you know, we're conflating eight different things, some of which are pernicious and some perhaps innocuous. One thing I've pointed out, for example, in the book on debt is that historically, markets almost invariably emerge from government military operations. Cash, I mean, credit systems of existed much longer. So you have credit, you know, in Sumer, in Egypt, people didn't buy things with cash. There was no cash. People didn't measure out tiny bits of silver or anything like that. They did things on credit, and they sort of every 6 months to a year, they sort of settled accounts, especially around harvest time. And a lot of villages in Europe would do the same thing in the Middle Ages. Every 98% of all transactions were credit. Basically, money was used by priests and soldiers, you know, violent people and religious people. Otherwise, nobody touched the stuff. So actual cash markets, they come out of government military operations because, you know, you don't want to extend credit to a soldier. They're heavily armed. They're just passing through. On the other hand, they're quite likely to have little bits of gold and silver on them that they've looted somewhere. So it kind of makes sense that you would, like, sort of government sort of systematically stamp it out into regular proportions and pay them in the stuff. But the key thing is taxes. You know, if you think about it, why would a ancient government demand money in taxes? You know, they could just grab the gold and silver mines. If Adam Smith was right and gold and silver simply became money because of sort of natural, inevitable reasons, because people were engaging in trade anyway, well, government could just grab the mines, they'll have all the money they want. What's the point of taking, and often they would grab the mines, right? So what's the point of taking all this gold and silver, stamping your picture on it, giving them away, and saying, okay, everybody give me one back again? Mm-hmm. Seems kind of pointless. Unless you realize that the big problem in the ancient world was feeding soldiers. You know, if you have 10,000 people in one place, it's bad enough. If you have 50, 100,000, you know, they're just going to eat everything within a day's walk of any, in any direction very quickly. So and either you got to employ another 100,000 people getting them food, or you can come up with the ingenious expedient of giving them a little piece of gold of your picture on it and then saying, okay, everybody else in the country has to give me one of those pieces of gold back again. So basically, you've just employed your entire population of feeding soldiers. And that's what people would do. And even in Rome, you see money where there were legions. People were using credit everywhere else. In the medieval world, the same thing. Wherever there's crusade going on or there's large numbers of armed people, you get cash nowhere else. So money has to do, comes out, this whole idea of the separation of markets and the state and feudalism is absurd. They completely came together. However, there were periods where they drifted apart. Mm-hmm. So medieval Islam is a great example. They created this sort of world where you could have a sort of free trade zone. A lot of like the ideas about Adam Smith used about the pin factory really come from medieval Islamic scholars, often Persian ones. I think it was Ghazali who has the, he had a needle factory, but you know, it was the same thing. A lot of Adam Smith's lines are borrowed directly from these sort of free market theorists from medieval Islam. But you know, their version of free market systems was very different. Yes, it involved money and somewhat credit, somewhat cash. But if you don't have a government that can enforce debts, it's got to work totally differently. So, for example, lending money at interest was illegal in medieval Islam. So, you know, any basis for a credit system, you know, had to be very different. In fact, they tended to have profit sharing rather than lending as a means of financing things. So they had complex forms of partnership involving sharing out of profits. And everything was based on trust if you don't have means of enforcement. So the moment you take a market, even if it comes out of a structure of violence, like war-making states, and have it become the basis for peaceful commerce, it actually changes. This is why anarcho-capitalists are ridiculous. You know, they assume that we're going to maintain these kind of these social relations, which have historically been based exclusively on coercion, in a system where coercion has been eliminated. In fact, even if money exists, people will start behaving totally differently about it if they don't have the means to violently force people to do things they haven't agreed to do. So I think that in a lot of ways, a lot of radical theorists, a lot of Marxists, have it kind of backwards. They have this idea that there's something, you know, there's this kind of germ in the very commodity relation itself. The moment you have money and commoditized things, that's a sort of microcosm, and the entire world of capitalism will inevitably emerge the moment you do that, which is a very pessimistic view. So either you have to totally eliminate anything that looks vaguely like money, or you're going to end up with, like, you know, financialized consumer capitalism. You know? This is not the case. Even if you do have a sort of markety, capitalistic-looking system, the moment you eliminate the element of coercion, it's going to start turning into something else.
Okay. I also have a question. It's a more general question. It's about imagination, the role of imagination for you as an anthropologist, as a scholar, but also as a political thinker, because you often emphasize the role of imagination. And I guess that looking to the past or paying attention to societies we usually don't pay attention is a way to imagine has other ways of being together.
Yeah, I think it has something to do with what made me an anthropologist, you know? I mean, I always say my parents, they were kind of working class intellectuals, you might say. My father fought in Spain. My mother was part of labor theater. She was a garment worker, but also a performer in labor plays. And My house was full of books. You know, I grew up surrounded by literature of various kinds, even though they were factory workers. But I looked at, and they were radicals, you know. But I remember looking on the shelves and realizing there was almost no literature of critique. You know, there was a volume one of Capital was there. You know, there's a couple things you have to have. But basically, if you work 9 to 5, you don't need a book to tell you that capitalism sucks. You know, I mean, that, you already know that. What they had a lot of was, well, they had anthropology. They had a lot of history. And they had a lot of science fiction. And they were thinking, yeah, that makes sense. It's like, you know, past, present, and future alternatives. You know, we know the system. We know why it's bad. We want to be able to think about what something else might look like, you know, when we're not actually working. And I think that that is really important. That's what anthropology contributes, that, you know, it gives us an idea of what another society might be like, of what other possibilities might be like. And people regularly come up with things you just never would have imagined or guessed, you know. But I think that in a broader sense, don't usually use this kind of language, but one point I thought, well, you know, you could think that the real difference between the left and the right historically has been that one is based on a political ontology of violence and the other is based on a political ontology of the imagination. Mm. And what I meant by that specifically was, by ontology, was like when someone says, well, let's be realistic, you know, what's really going on? What's the hidden reality they don't want you to talk about? Well, you know, for someone who's on the right wing of the political spectrum, that usually has to do with relations of force. You know, ultimately, it's all held together by the threat of coercion and violence. We don't like to talk about it. When they talk about real politic, right? You know, that's what they mean, violence, you know. Which is interesting, too, like realists in international relations. There's institutionalists and realists, right? Realists are the ones who say that, like, you know, France or England will pursue their particular interest in whatever way that is to their advantage. How is that a realistic position? France and England don't exist. They're imaginary constructs. You know, and when you had a king, the king had interests, right? The country doesn't have an interest. It's a bunch of people that exist only in the imagination as an entity. So you know, the only thing that France or England has that makes them real is that they can kill you. They have the means of violence that they can direct. All right, so realism in that right-wing sense is a recognition of the realities of violence. So what is the left-wing reality that we're not supposed to talk about, but which, when they say, oh, let's be realistic, you know, it has to do with production, imagination, creation. You know, the fact is somebody had to make all this stuff. Somebody had to think of it all. You know, everything you see in this room, there's somebody who sat around saying, what might these people be, and what might they need, and how could we, you know, all those acts of imagination that go into creating that TV or that camera or that sign or that wire, you know, gets wiped out by the history of commodity relations. And so we're surrounded by objects that sort of embody intentionality and imagination of people that we don't know who they were, exactly who they were thinking. That's like how you end up in a world of commodity fetishism, as Marx said. But it's ultimately about imagination. It's actually interesting that way, because whenever I try to talk about Marx to undergraduates, I told the story of Margaret Mead. She wanted to go to New Guinea originally to study children's animism. You know, how is it that, you know, how children are always saying, oh, I don't want to offend this coat by wearing that coat. And, you know, I try to divide it up or try to, they want to be fair to objects. They treat all objects as if they had personalities and feelings and thoughts. And thought, well, maybe there's a continuum between childhood animism, we lose ours and they keep theirs and it becomes a religion. So he shows up in New Guinea and discovered that kids in New Guinea don't do that. They don't actually act like it's only European and American kids who sort of animate everything. And why is that? Well, why do they treat things as if they embody intentions? And it's because they do. They live in a world where, you know, how many things around us were not made by somebody? Like, there's some trees out there. Whereas if you live in New Guinea, you know, you're surrounded by things that just grew and had nothing to do with you. So we live in this sort of fetishized world where imagination is like sort of impinging on us on all sides, yet we disavow it. Yeah. So in a way, it's the kind of essence of radical thought. Whenever I think of it, I, you know, familiar with John Holloway? He's sort of like the poet of Marxism. I love the way he has a sort of dreamy, beautiful version of sort of basic radical thought. And he has a book called Crack Capitalism. That wasn't originally going to be the title. I think it's a terrible title, personally. The original title of that book was going to be Stop Making Capitalism, which I thought was brilliant, because when he first presented it, he said, well, you know, we treat capitalism as if it's this thing imposed on us, but it's simply our own actions coming back at us. I mean, capitalism exists because every morning we wake up and we create capitalism. If one morning we woke up and didn't create capitalism, we'd have something else. So that's sort of the radical question, you know, why is that so hard to do? And that's a question of imagination. Like, what would it take to just wake up one morning and make something else?
Yes, that's a very cool idea. We are going to the end of the interview. I have two last questions about two people who don't share many things in common. The first one is Michel Foucault and the other one is Donald Trump.
Okay.
So first with Michel Foucault, because I was very interesting by the critique you do to Michel Foucault, and specifically his idea that the social order mainly relies on knowledge. Say, no, it's more on violence. Can you elaborate a little on this?
Well, you know, Foucault is a very interesting character, and he kept changing his mind about a lot of key things, so it's hard to talk about Foucault as a single entity. You know, he goes from being an almost Durkheimian to being an arch-structuralist to being a Nietzschean to his sort of later phase, the ethical phase, which I think is quite promising of other things, and sadly cut off, I think, pointed in a very different direction. So I don't reject the works of Foucault so much as I really am annoyed by the way American academics have sort of made this religion out of Foucault. There's the worship of Foucault that I'd like to think Foucault himself would have been quite disturbed by. But what happened in American academia, is sort of a training ground for American bureaucracy. America has long been a very bureaucratic society. You know, bureaucratic capitalism, corporate capitalism really emerges out of Germany and America. In many ways, America is more a German country than an English one, despite the accident of their speaking English. The American university system is explicitly based on the German one and not on the British. So for a long time, Max Weber was the sort of god of social sciences in America. And that makes sense for a place which is both a training ground for bureaucrats and for social scientists who are critical of that system, but not that much, you know. So Weber gives you the grounds to be sort of like almost sentimentally opposed to the extremes of the sort of rationalized life, but at the same time gives you the grounds for saying there's not really much you can do about it. That Weberian hegemony was very much challenged in the 60s on American campuses, and people like Talcott Parsons, who was the sort of impresario of Weberianism at the time, was completely delegitimated and became the sort of whipping boy for everything people hated in the status quo. And for a while, people played around with various forms of Marxism, semiotics, and French theory. But eventually, they came around to Foucault and fixed on him sort of as the new Weber. And it strikes me in America, Foucault has the same function. You almost talk about vulgar Foucauldianism in the same way as they used to talk about vulgar Marxism. That, you know, one could even say that Max Weber and Michel Foucault were the only two intelligent people of the 20th century who studied bureaucracy and came to the conclusion that bureaucracy should be seen as basically effective. Weber saw it as so effective that it would gradually displace everything else, and Foucault seemed to think it shaped reality itself. You know, the bureaucratic means like established our very definition of truth, really there's almost nothing outside bureaucratic procedures for Foucault. Now this played a very strong role in reconstituting something like the old type of Weberian authority in American campuses, because Foucault had the same role. He was the anti-Marx. You know, you could say, well, Marx is simplifying everything by turning it into economics and power over versus lack of power. It's really something that flows throughout the system and it's multifarious and unavoidable in many ways. And it was the same basic idea, as at least the way Foucault was interpreted, as what Weber had done before. So it's an answer to the Marxists, and at the same time it provides people who are being trained to be part of the bureaucratic system to have a certain ironic detachment from it, but at the same time a sort of fatalistic acceptance at the same time. So it's that Foucault that I really object to, as opposed to any particular theory, some of which I think are brilliant and some of which I think are absurd. Now, so that vulgar Foucauldianism has been very pernicious because, you know, campuses were the center of radical organizing in the late 60s and early 70s, and gradually they became turned into sort of breeding grounds for the reproduction of this kind of what the right wing calls the liberal elite, which is something that does exist, where, you know, children of a certain class were allowed to monopolize those positions where one could be paid to pursue values other than the economic. And Foucault became the sort of perfect theorist, the idea of power knowledge, that all forms of knowledge are forms of power, for people facing this problem where essentially they were more and more writing positions papers for social movements that no longer existed. So the social movements on campus dissolved away, but people still continued to act as if they were speaking to them. And Foucault provided an excuse for that, since all knowledge is power anyway. And the idea that knowledge is power is very reassuring for people who have more and more knowledge and less power. At the same time, you have a return of just pure violence as a governing principle, which is just almost totally ignored on campuses at the same time as this happens. In American society in the 80s and the 90s, when Foucault becomes hegemonic, you know, you suddenly have security guards all over the place and actual people with guns and sticks. And, you know, in the 60s, like if students occupied a building, they wouldn't bring in the police. Now they bring in SWAT teams. You know, the pure coercion becomes more and more explicit. And, you know, people are beaten up and arrested for like crossing the street wrong, you know, on campus. And somehow we're not supposed to think about violence as itself as the governing principle of power. The example I always give is of the library, you know. Worked in academic libraries. You know, imagine you want to go into the library to see, take out a book by Foucault about why violence is no longer important, but you know, don't have a validation stamp on your ID card. And you say to the nice person at the desks, I know I don't have a validation on my ID card, but this, it's very important that I see this article by Foucault about the unimportance of coercion. It's just really critical for something, idea I'm developing, so I'm going to walk in anyway. What is likely to happen?
Go up.
Yeah, well, somebody with a big stick is going to arrive and threaten to hit you. And in fact, there have been examples of this. Since I wrote that, people have been sending me articles about students getting tasered and tied up and being arrested, you know, variously beaten up in libraries for behaving like that.
Okay, and that's a good transition to Donald Trump. You gave an interview recently saying that you analyze his election as in the old tradition of corporatism.
Oh, Trump, yes, indeed. I think that the analysis of what Trump is about has been incredibly superficial. Yeah. I mean, I think it's because the sort of liberal classes are just so flabbergasted and confused that they can just throw invective, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like with Bush, oh, he's stupid, he's a moron, you know? There was no analysis that, like, maybe if this guy's president, he's got something going on that, like, we might want to think about it. In the case of Trump, I think that the obvious thing to say is, all right, he's a real estate guy. He's a construction and a real estate guy. That's what he is. That's what he knows how to do well. I mean, his address of most social problems seems to involve construction and real estate, you know, let's build a wall, you know, that sort of thing. All right, so he's a construction real estate guy. Historically, I read an article back in the 90s about who funds different political factions in America. And they made the very interesting point that left-wing Democrats, back then there were people like Harkin, you know, sort of classic New Deal people, you know, they get some money from Hollywood and the kind of sources you'd think they'd get. But insofar as there's elements of the capitalist class that will fund a left-wing politician, it's mostly real estate. And yeah, it seems weird at first, but then you think about it, it makes a lot of sense because, as they point out, these are guys who can't really export their product. They have an interest in general prosperity. They want people to be able to afford a house. So redistributive politics, you know, will actually, a lot of that money redistributed will go back to them again. That makes perfect sense. So something obviously changed over the years, and I think what happened under Clinton was a kind of alliance between real estate and the financial system, whereby they said, well, we'll just lend the money for mortgages, we'll create the money. Various scams ensued, and basically in 2008 the whole thing blew up, and it was all about real estate. It was all about Countrywide and subprime mortgages and so forth and so on, sort of extending loans to people who couldn't otherwise afford a house. So in 2008 that pact broke, and you could see Trump's campaign as definitively representing the divorce between real estate and finance. Okay. And he was running against Hillary Clinton, who, as he continually pointed out, was essentially a creature of finance, who gives million-dollar talks to Goldman Sachs, whose like contributions, gets far more contributions from financial corporations than the Republicans ever did. I mean, the finance is one of the only branches of the capitalist class that funds everybody, but they fund the Democrats a little bit more. Those are their people. And so I thought, all right, maybe we could do a kind of 18th Brumaire analysis here, right? Who represents what? Hillary obviously represents the interests of finance, but she also represents the interests of empire, because in America, finance and empire are kind of the same thing. You have a global financial system which is guaranteed by U.S. military power and is essentially the tribute-taking mechanism. They say that the sort of balance of payments, the balance of trade in America is primarily based on seigniorage, one of those words where you're not supposed to really know what it means, but what it ultimately means is the economic advantage you get from being the guy who says what money is. So if America, you know, gets to decide what money is, you know, like they get more money out of the deal, obviously. So this is what basically keeps stuff, more stuff flowing into America than flows out again. So essentially you can see it as tribute in classic imperial terms, just dressed up slightly differently. So the financial system, the imperial system, the military system are all tied together. So unsurprisingly, you have Hillary Clinton, who is both the finance candidate and the war candidate. She's like, wants to start a war with Russia. She's into aggressive military expansion. She was the person who was all about killing Gaddafi and going to Libya. You know, she's a financial hawk. Then you have Trump. Trump, as you point out, is a corporatist in the classic 20th century tradition. And this goes back to people like John Kenneth Galbraith pointed this out, I think, when he talked about the technostructure of corporations. When you have large bureaucratic corporations, the center of gravity of those bureaucratic corporations tends to center on what they're making. You know, if you're a car manufacturer, or you're a pen manufacturer, or you're a perfume manufacturer, you know, the only thing you all have in common is you're all interested in cars, pens, or perfume. So the structure of the corporation, the researchers, the workers, the executives, you know, their commonality is around their products, and they tend to be interested in making more and better pens or perfume. And they see finance and the imperatives of finance, which are often quite different, as interfering with the real purpose of the corporation. So there's a tendency to see finance as this kind of feudal leftover. Those are the rentier classes. Keynes was very much embodies this. He talks about the euthanasia of the rentier class. We need to just get rid of all these old-fashioned feudal people. This comes out of people like Ricardo, talks about like the landlords having an interest which is contrary to that of all other sections of society. So that idea that like you have the people who are actually making stuff, you know, the good moral capitalists and the bad, you know, rentier capitalists, is an old corporatist idea, and it says that workers and corporate bureaucrats and you know, all these guys really have a common interest against those financial guys. And you can take that in the nice Keynesian social democracy direction, which is somewhat nationalistic and often imperialistic. But America, we talk about like sort of Archie Bunker, working class who identify with their bosses, you know, or racists and scary nationalists. You know, you can take it in the fascist direction and say that the financiers are all Jews and you want to kill them. But, you know, it has disturbing elements, but it's also a traditional basis of social democracy. Put workers on the board, that sort of thing. Now, Trump obviously represents the right-wing version of that, but that's essentially what he's doing. He is, as I say, not only is he real estate, he's in construction, and he teams up with Peter Thiel, who's one of the big powers behind the throne, founder of PayPal, who is a sort of voice for those elements in the Silicon Valley class of capitalists who want to move back into high-tech production. Something we have in common, we've talked to about together, is that we kind of want to think about what will actually get us back to the world of, you know, rocket ships and teleportation, all that stuff we thought we were going to have by now, immortality drugs, he's particularly into that. All right, so you have people like Peter Thiel who want to go back into high-tech industry. You have the construction real estate guy. They form an alliance on sort of corporatist grounds, and they make an appeal to the working class. And they say, look, ultimately, on nationalist grounds, we have more in common with each other than we do with those cosmopolitan elite financiers like Hillary Clinton likes, you know. And so he, owing to the peculiar nature of America as an imperial power, therefore, the fascist, and basically is a fascist, he's running a fascist version of corporatist grounds, the fascist is also the peace candidate. He's like, well, let's not go into all these wars. You know? And, you know, it's plausible that if anybody is going to start disassembling the American empire, dismantling it, well, it's got to be a right-wing populist. You know, the left-winger would never be allowed to get any, you know, they have to prove their macho credentials by invading somebody. You know? At best, they can be like Obama and say, well, I'm not going to start wars. I don't really have to. But there's no question of dismantling the system as a whole. Only someone like Trump could do that. Now, to me, there's a lot of indications that he was actually serious. I mean, that's the question. Was this just a stunt? Partly because of the nature of the alliance that he got together, but partly also because of the nature of the people that he chose as his primary appointees in early years. I mean, a lot of them seemed like they were nuts or crazy or weirdos, but they were people who, if you were going to shake things up, you would have to appoint someone like that. Someone who didn't have any constituency within the institutions, so he wouldn't become the voice of the State Department or whatever, you know, whatever institution it was to the president, but would rather represent the president to that institution. So it seemed like that's what he was going to do. The response, of course, was virulent. Almost immediately, the system tried to like kick him out again, almost as if he was this alien virus imposed on them. And they seemed to be using the somewhat absurd idea of that Russia somehow fixed our election, which is like, you know, the idea of the CIA complaining that a foreign power is trying to like to subvert democracy by manipulating a democratic election is one of the great ironies of world history. I mean, could they honestly say this with a straight face, the CIA? So it seems like the battle is over that. You know, the national security state imperial structure is kicking back at the even slight potential that he might have been serious about what he was proposing.
Okay, thanks for this very complete analysis, and thanks for the interview. We were very happy to be with you, and I hope we
really
will read you again.
Thanks.
Thank you, David Graeber.